Okay, so this are preliminary. Instead of giving the well-structured talk about things which I think I understand, I will give some preliminary results on strings and cosmological background, which is something we've been doing in Jerusalem, Shmuel Litzur, Amit Givon, and myself, and David Kutasov from Chicago. And in that case, as you will see, there are many things which we don't understand. So actually, I won't explain, anyhow, part of the preliminary results, so I won't explain why it could be very important to do string theory in a cosmological background. But I will tell you more or less what our motto was, because in this case, it's a difficult problem, and we don't know actually how to formulate many of the questions. So the idea was more to try and look a little bit for the answers, and then see how that goes. And the idea would be to follow the rules of string theory and see in a well-protected environment as possible. Not to try to introduce singularities in an abrupt manner. Just take some system which you think you understand rather well and then try and see what comes out. So in such a situation, we tried, as I said, to restrict ourselves and constrain ourselves the most possible. So we went into a situation of the coset model, where you start out with some theory, like ADS3, let's say, cross S3, cross some intended manifold, which after quite some time, one has a feeling that one has some handle on it, and it's a well-defined theory, and then just gauge it. And hoping that if you gauge it in a normally free way, what you do actually, as we're discussing, project out states, and that if you started with a good system, you gauged it, it will remain a good system. And belief we will need, because you will see that things get complicated along the way. But this is the point of view. And the point of view is actually even harder, if you wish. There is an assumption. Let's say we had a coset compact model, let's say SU2 over U1, power fermions. So in that case, there would be no doubt that you have a general expansion, and it makes sense to do perturbation theory. And you have control on the coupling constant. You just choose it whatever you want. And the ideology here would be that actually, this is what we feel at least now, that's also really the same case here. And I will discuss the parallels when we go along. So the particular model is we are going to take is a model which was, see I have here, this should be a K. And this was a model of the types studied quite some years ago by Napi and Witten and by Kunas and Sissens for Kostas and Dieter Lust. And in this case, we will discuss the model, but it's some specific coset which gives rise semi-classically to a topological, to a cosmological background. Now, the idea is going to be, as I said, that algebra is the thing which is pushing us. That's the thing that we trust. Geometry, we try to extract, but we think about it as a semi-classical thing. And if it gives us difficulties, we say, well, the algebra should protect us. And the structure which one is going to get is actually a space in which one has 12, let's say, basic units which repeat themselves an infinite amount of time. And these 12 units have the form of four units in which you have everything is compact, and the time direction is really the direction along the y-axis, in which in a semi-classical picture you would say the universe bangs, the crunches bangs, and goes on. And there are four basic units which are different, and then that repeats itself. This will be explained later. And then there are whiskers at each of these points from which manifolds which have a connection to infinity exist. And in these manifolds, A, there will be time-like singularities, which will discuss their origin, and B, they're going to be closed time-like curves. This is going.
This is the picture of the space-time.
Yes. This is the picture of the space-time, but this will be explained as we go on, but just to show that that's where we're going to reach. And the basic results are going to be that we can write the vertex operator all over this object, and the vertex operator can be given physics interpretation in certain regions. We'll discuss that. but the main point would be that you can write down the vertex operators, and vertex operators resolve something of string scale. So I mean, they're not really local, but they should tell you some string resolution. And this results, and I will show some of them. And then we get a large depletion of the number of states in the system. It will come out, and we will have to explain large depletion in comparison to what, and we will do that. But these are the two basic results. This is the geometry, and this is
the geometry repeats it. It's cyclic, actually.
No, it's not cyclical. This is a eventually there is a cover here, so there is a phase which goes on. So these are 12 basic units, but these 12 basic units come afterwards, not in terms of the metric, but in terms of vertex operators. They are going to have epsilon phases, phase structure as you go up. So from the algebraic point of view, you have an SL2R model, you have an SU2. Finely algebra, and then you have some attendant manifold to complete the central charge, C hat, let's say, to 10, and then you gauge. Now, if you start the easiest way, which won't serve our case for the cosmological model, would be just to gauge, let's say, SL2R by one U1, one subgroup, and the SU2 by another, and then that system would be, if this U1 would be some space-like non-compact U1 in SL2R, you'll get the Lorentzian two-dimensional black hole times power fermions times some attended manifold. But actually what Mackey and Witten did, they took the most general case of a linear combination of two of these currents, so you get two orthogonal currents, where you pick, of course in SU2 you have only the compact, the Kartantzev algebra is all compact generators, but in SL2R you have a non-compact space-like generator. You mix the two with some angle. I will discuss it at the end only in a particular case for this talk. But there is a whole family of gauging you have to do. And the rule we learned from the Lagrangian formulations of these systems is that you have to gauge it in a way that the U1 charges are arranged in representations which are anomaly free. So you have to take care that you don't introduce any anomalies. And it was successful in the past. So this is the thing that one wants to do. So if one looks at the various U1s, so we have SL2R left, SL2R right, SU2 left and SU2 right. SL2R left has a current J3 and the right part which is denoted J3 bar, it will be I3 and I3 bar for SU2 left and SU2 right. And now for a general mixing, the charge, let's say on the left hand side, would be some combination of the eigenvalues of the zero Fourier component of J3 and with some combination with that of I3, and because of the anomaly free conditions this will be equal minus J bar 3 zero component, and the other current will be the orthogonal combination, and that is taken to be, in order to have no anomalies, to be equal to I bar third component, the zeros, the Hamming transform, whatever you want to call it. So, in general, what this implies for the charges I don't know if the music suits it or not.
I think
that
Raphael
already
went.
Right?
Raphael went to Asperger.
That's very good.
So you had for a general value of alpha, you have the charge M alpha equal R and S. I think I skipped that. I didn't emphasize that. R and S of the SU2 left and SU2 right charges, and then the M's and M primes are linear combinations of them, and they are 1 over cosine alpha R minus S tangent alpha, and M alpha prime is S. I don't know if you followed on how this is done, but let's say we can stop here. This is how the charges are related. Now, this is normalized so that for alpha equal pi over 2, the models decouple. and you get the Lorentzian black hole times power fermions. But for alpha equals zero, which is the case we will take, you have maximum sense mixing. And this is what I'm going to discuss today. Even though there is structure also as a function of alpha, and there is there are various t-duality structure as you move alpha. All these aspects, I think I'll hardly mention. Okay, so now, then we said that we take R and S to be the values of SU2, and recall that in SU2 we have an affinely algebra of level K, so we know, of course, in SU2 that R and S can get values between J and minus J, but we also know that J itself is bounded, dependent by K minus 1 over 2, depending on what model exactly one is studying. So this is, in any case, this will turn out to be very constraining. Now, how are the different k's of the SM2R level k and the SU2 level k prime, let's say, how are they correlated? So we would like the central charge to be essentially 4 for the part which is not the attendant M manifold. So if one takes the N equal 2 Wilczek supersymmetric k's, then this, for any value of k, it's enough to take k equal k prime. If one is doing the bosonic k's, then because of shifts, various shifts which occur, this is true in the large K limit. But in any case, for simplification here, I will all the time put in the equations that K equals K prime, and then the central charge was arranged to be 4. Of course, the K prime of SU2 is quantized, but the K of SM2R is not quantized, so there's always a solution to the request that this be equal 4. So that means that if you start with SL2R cross SU2 and you arrange that the central charge before gauging was 6, which is what you can do, and after you gauge 2 normal U1 currents, you lose, each one takes a bit, its bit of the central charge, so you take minus 2, so all in all, the, let's say, C hat would be in this case 4. So this is the system one is studying. Now, in order to be able to extract the result, it's useful first to forget a moment our goal and now just do things in SF2R. And it will turn out eventually, because of the way the coset structure works, that actually it's worthwhile to spend time in SF2R and in SU2, and then we come back to the coset. For the time being, forget the coset, we're doing SF2R, even forget the SU2. Now, SF2R is, of course, a smooth manifold. But when you view it from the point of view of its space-like non-compact manifold, it looks more complicated. And of course, this is just a question of choice of coordinates. But when you gauge the system, this choice of coordinates will become important. So the point of view we take now is looking at SL2R, but from the point of view of the coordinates, which will be useful for the gauging. So we take it, when we do the...
That should be one manifest isometry.
Well, it is an isometry of the system, of course. But it's not compact.
What do you mean?
Because you did it.
I think it's not. What do you mean?
Okay, it will be clear in a moment.
By choosing coordinates so that the metric is manifestly dependent in that direction.
Let me remind you about SU2. So we do Euler angles. So we have 3 Euler angles, and we choose which axes are convenient for us. And in the textbook, we take the z-axis on both sides and the y-axis in the middle, from which we get the Wigner functions, etc. So the question is, who sits on the side? And in this case, who would sit on the side is actually the space like non-compact U1. And that will cause you to have problem. Well, it will mean that you need patches. Had you chosen the time-like compact one, you could do it with one set of coordinates. So a general matrix, so this is not this. This is in the case when you take the time-like coordinate, which you're more familiar with, which is compact, then this is the parameterization you do for SL2R, and in this case you have a universal cover, you don't have, there's no problem. Sorry, it's not universal in the sense it's a group, but the cover has only one patch. You don't have to break it into various patches. But that's not this case, okay? Because out here you will see it's a different sub, it's the one which will be gauged. Now, so a general group element is A, B, C, D, and A, D minus B, C equals 1. This is the definition of SF2R, where A, B, C, and D are real. So as I said, G will be covered by 12, at least, actually 12 is Gosso model. There is more refinement, but I won't discuss now the refinement. There are 12 patches, and they go in the following manner.
There is E, 12 patches.
Yep.
Of that type.
Okay, we'll see what, yeah, we'll see how, I mean, this, we don't take credit for. This was done in the mass literature. They know about it, and all this ugliness, if you wish, or beauty affairs, or in the mass books.
And so too are the same as ADS 3, right?
That's right.
Well, so, I mean, I'm trying to relate this to...
But you click on Minkowski,
This is Minkowski.
Minkowski.
And so the ADS 3. I'm trying to understand, I mean, is there any useful way I can use my intuitions from ADS 5?
Later I will go to Paul Kovacevic's.
Okay,
but let me, right now, let's... Disregard your intuition and just show the facts. I mean, this is how this thing looks like. So, okay.
Sorry, but I mean, isn't it true that your compact you want would just be the sort of time, global time translation?
This would be sigma 2.
ADS.
This would be sigma 2, yeah.
Right, so that's the thing which is periodic before you unwrap it in ADS. Mm-hmm. And this non-compact U1 that you're using is, I guess, a boost.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose the reason you need patches is because there's horizons.
We'll discuss it. All the reasons will come. Why horizons? We'll see this in a few moments how this comes. In any case, at first the fact. So you have these two z-axis rotations sitting on this side. One with an angle alpha and one with an angle beta. That's well defined. And as you said, this is like a boost, or like a scaling transformation. And what you have in here is actually the more complicated stuff for which you need the 12 coordinates, and I will discuss them. Now, so this will come in a moment, the more detailed description. Now, I want to remind, because that will be important when we gauge, that there is, of course, this is an SL2R left cross SL2R right symmetry of the West-Domino Winter Novikov model on this manifold, and that is manifested by the fact that the way the symmetry acts is by multiplying by the left and by the right and by the left the group element G, where these two operations HR and H left are independent of each other, and in SL2R. And to get the gauged model, what you actually do is you identify the elements which sit along the orbit which you the symmetry traces spans for you. Okay, so that means in particular that G and this operation on G are going to be identified if you use sigma 3 as the group you want to do the gauging. And the way it manifests itself will be useful in a while. On the matrix element, is that, let's say A becomes an A times exponent of alpha plus beta, which is again like a boost thing. D just will act in a way that A times D remains constant. B will be multiplied by the exponent of alpha minus beta, and C is by the exponent of beta minus alpha. Now eventually, this is a group element, and eventually you want to describe the unitary representation for that. Well, that will come to the point which Jerry was discussing about where the singularities or in the parameterization may appear. So what you know is that you want the unitary representation under these two non-compact groups to go like this phase. So when you do the analysis, you realize that A times D and B times C remain constant under the transformation. A over D and B over C are multiplied by appropriate exponentials. So that means that actually the unitary representation is going to look like some function of either the product AD, or because AD minus BC is 1, BC, it's up to you to decide, but it's just a function of the product. That's the part which one will have to find. And here sit A over D to a power which is determined, okay, when it's writing down, this is a unitary representation. We will discuss in detail what sits in the ket and what sits in the bra, but you will not be surprised that there is here an M and an M bar in the ket and in the bra, and these are the M and M bars which sit here. So now we go back to what Jerry was saying. It's obvious from here that the points, this is an I, notice, so that the points A, where either A, B, C, or D vanish, are special points from the point of view of the patches. And indeed, these are those special points. Then they can also intersect and become even more special. You will see that. But that's how you can expose and see the special points. So in particular, the eigenfunctions may have a special behavior when you have one of these situations or even more zeros at hand. So in other words, what we saw is that the manifold SL2R splits naturally in regions in which the products of AD or BC remain, have some definite sum, because the transformation is not going to change the sign of anybody, but just a scale transformation or boost. So there are four regions, if you, that's one way to count, AD positive, BC positive are four regions, and the other combinations each would give another set of four regions. So overall you would have 12 regions. That's one way to gain intuition into what are the various regions. Now, the different patches, all this is an SL2R, we didn't get the patch.
The determinant should be
The determinant remains one, yes.
How? AD minus.
It works.
AD minus BC, the third case would be negative.
AD minus, why?
Because AD...
What does that mistake? AD because I'm sure BC less.
For AD to be negative and BC positive, AD equals 1 plus BC.
Right. I think it's
the other one.
Both negative.
Yeah, both negative. Both negative.
Sorry. Yeah,
both negative. Thank you. Okay. So the different patches are distinguished. So thank you for this, correcting this typo, by the value of a U one left cross U one R invariant quantity W, which was introduced by Newton, and this variable W has the following structure. That is the following thing: you multiply G by sigma 3 on both sides, and then you multiply it by G to the minus 1. Now, maybe Jerry knows of something more geometric. I mean, it's clear that such an object is invariant under rotations along the sigma 3 axis, so it captures that quality. But I don't know if it has some more natural geometric interpretation.
Let's see. Geometrically, you can think of SL2R is ADS3, and ADS3 is just this hypersurface sitting in a flat Minkowski space of signature 2-2. Mm-hmm. Okay, so all the symmetries of ADS come from Lorentz groups. It's the SO22 sort of presentation of the symmetries. Mm-hmm. So you can think of them either as sort of the two rotations in the, you know, the time-like two-plane or the space-like two-plane. That's global time translations and ordinary spatial rotations and the usual coordinates. And all the other ones are boosts. So, I mean, I haven't made the translation exactly, but your symmetry must be one of the boosts.
Yes.
And all boosts are equivalent, because it's by the symmetries, you know, that they're boosts. So,
but how did one guess that this is a natural quantity to look at?
Well, that must be some invariant distance.
Okay, which is
very under the boost.
So that's exactly the point. Mm-hmm. It'd be nice for me to know what exactly, in what invariant distance in the group that is.
But I think we have to work it out.
Okay, in any case, this quantity in particular is twice 2AD minus 1, and we saw that AD remains invariant, so this quantity is going to remain invariant. And now, what you see is the following. There are regions in which are denoted here 1, in which W is larger than 2. In the regions where W is larger than 2, which is this here and this here, both of them have space-like, you can go as far as you want in space. Then you have the regions where W is between 2, there can be equality here, signs here. When W is between 2 and minus 2, these are actually the regions which, after gauging, are going to give this universe without closed time-like singularities, which is going to go from a bank to a crunch. And these are these four objects here. And now these objects have the property, for example, the simplest one is one in which, so here is a matrix, and I'll go back to it in a moment, but let's say it's of the form cosine theta minus sine theta, cosine theta, and we are sitting in the first quadrant. So sitting in the first quadrant A, this is the part of SL2R where all the matrix elements are smaller or equal than 1, and B, it has the structure plus minus plus plus being in the first quadrature. So this is the object here, and then what happens is the first line of singularities in the coordinatization appears at B equals zero. When you have B equals zero, when you cross it, the sign of B is going to change. So B here was negative, so going up here it will be plus. The other line is C equals zero, so when you change that one, C is going to go from plus to minus, and that is going to be that object. Now, if you look at the connectedness values of this, then you see the following. You can reach from, these are, so Arab numerals are object are parts where you can reach to infinity. And Roman numerals, you can't reach to infinity. All Roman numerals are smoothly connected to each other.
What's it? What do you mean infinity?
Infinity, I can take a space per, a spatial parameter and take it all the way to infinity. I can't do it here. I mean, you can see it only in this cosine theta.
For example, it's
clear. Actually, sorry, that's misleading. That's a time variable. But it will become clear later. But let me say, for the words are the following. One way to look at what happens inside here are various spheres. And these spheres cannot, will not be able, you can't take them to infinity after gauging. Before gauging, talking after gauging. Whatever will sit in here, you won't be able to take this any spatial coordinate to infinity. We'll see how it happens. It's not. Have to wait a moment to come. Now, the points here will remain where you can go to infinity. Now, the points 1 and 1 prime you can connect without going through the singularities, because you can take the ratio of B over C, for example, fixed. But we saw that functions depend on B over C. So you can go with a fixed ratio of B over C, connect 1 and 1 prime, 2 and 2 prime, 3 and 3 prime, and 4 and 4 prime. But if you want to connect any Arab numeral to a Roman numeral, you have to go through a singularity.
Is this a curvature singularity? Do you know if the curvature?
Well, remember, this is ADS. So no, not yet. This is still ADS. So here, everything. I'm preparing you for the gauging, but this is not yet the gauging. So on ADS, the curvature is constant.
Is it just coordinate patches?
This is just for this for the time being. It's coordinate patches. Eventually, there will be a particular point. We understand its origin where the semi-classical curvature. Explodes.
Are you going to write? Are you going to tell us what the metric is? In these coordinates, so we can see what that compact.
Yes, but right now we don't need it, so I won't. But when we need it, I will. So this is about the connectedness properties. And now, if I promised a little bit, I don't know if it will help to attach to former intuitions. So one possibility is to go to and identify G with minus G. Then instead of SL2R, you actually have PSL2R, and in that case, you have only six of the patches. And this, these are the six patches which survive in that case, and that is the Poincaré patch which you get from the universal cover. Now, of course, both PSL2R and in the next transparency the metric will appear, and its double cover are both not simply connected. So we don't want to have ab initio closed timeline curves. The ones which the theory deals us, we will take, but we want at least from the beginning to start without having those. So when you go to the universal cover, then of course this disposes of these closed time networks. But new ones will come in. So the Poincaré patch is naturally, if you wish, obtained from the analytic continuation of ADS3. And I don't know now if that helps your intuition. In the Euclidean version, like what we were saying, you have something of that nature. Then there are two disconnected components depending on if X naught is positive or negative. And in this case, we pick one of them. Euclidean ADS3 picks one of them. And this is the way we would have written it. And in this case, finally, this coordinate, now the familiar coordinates U, gamma plus and gamma minus, but in particular U becomes positive. So this actually looks at all ABCDs with A positive. And therefore, when I've written down those patches, those were the patches where A was, gets out to be positive. And this is the metric in these coordinates on that. I don't know if that helps your, this was your question where I blocked you before.
Yeah.
I'm not going to use it anywhere, but that's, that helps you to. Okay, so now we want to look at these 12 different regions, different patches, how they're in their microscopic manner, because that's actually eventually how one calculates the vertex operators. So first, we look at the group element. So the group element in SL2R, we have three coordinates, alpha and beta, or the boosts, on which were like the z-axis. And then theta is a coordinate sitting in the middle, in some manner. And then there are three discrete coordinates, and they are the following. So what sits in the side, we pulled up the z-axis. What sits in the middle is either the matrix minus I to the power epsilon 1, and epsilon 1 can either be 0 or not. So this gives you two options, two different group elements. Then you have I sigma 2 to the power epsilon 2, and epsilon 2 can be 0 or 1, so this gives you another two options. And then this matrix here can have can be of three types. One type I've discussed, which is a compact U1 type, where you have cosine theta minus sine theta and cosine theta. The other type, where the matrix element will be larger than one, would be cos hyperbolic, sine hyperbolic, cos hyperbolic, and sine hyperbolic. And then there is a question, for example, is sine hyperbolic larger than zero or not? And this you get by inverting the matrix. So there are three matrices that you have. So there are three discrete choices. One gets two options, the other two options, and these three options, overall, this gives you the 12 options. Okay? So this is how the system looks like. Now, in the case of phi SL2R, you have the Poincaré patch, and you have actually... what is this? Yeah, sorry. For PSL2R, you have epsilon 1 equals 0 because we made an identification of G and minus G. So the minus I element is redundant. And therefore, you have only half the option 6, and those are the 6 which I've outlined. So now we know what is the unitary representation of what object we want to put in here. And now comes the question, how do you denote the cats or the brass? And this depends on the representations here. Of SL2R. So now there are two, the following pieces of information. We know that there is a Casimir, which is minus J times J plus 1. In general, there are four types of representations, but we usually focus on two, the continuous and the discrete representations. And in that case, in the continuous case, J is minus a half plus IS, where S is some real number. And in the discrete representation, J gets other values, which I will discuss in a few moments. But for the continuous representation, there is another index of the representation, and that is the label, it's a label epsilon. If you are sitting in PSL2R, epsilon gets only one value, so you don't need to worry about it. Then you are back to what you used in SU2, and if I give you J, you know what the representation is. If you are sitting in SL2R, you need two values it can get. There are two different representations which have the same value of J. And if you're sitting in the universal cover, then actually you have a unit circle of different representations. So in that case, there is a running parameter. So if you look at the angle exponent of I pi epsilon, for PSL2R, epsilon vanishes. For SL2R, it's either 0 or 1. And in general, it's all this. So just to label the representation which sits in here, you need to give two pieces of information. And that is J and epsilon, and J and epsilon. Of course, the representation, the unitary representation here will not mix different representations, so it's diagonal in these J's and epsilon. And that epsilon is not to be confused with epsilon 1 or epsilon 2, it has nothing to do with it. But the representation of which appears in the ket, not in the parametrization of the matrix. Okay, so now the next thing is to look at the what is the magnetic number? What do you pick from the Cartan subalgebra? So you pick from the Cartan subalgebra one generator M, and we know we expect its eigenvalues to be of the form M, where M is now any number. It's not necessarily it's not quantized, and it obtains any number, but on top of it, what we are not used to usually, or at least I'm not used, is that for any given M, there's also an ambiguity. There are two different values, there are two different members of a given representation which have the same value of M, and they get indices plus and minus. So overall, in order to write down a ket, you specify the representation by J and epsilon, and you specify the other, the place in the representation by M and by plus and minus. And this plus and minus actually remain also when you have when you go to the cover. This doesn't get richer. It just remains plus and minus. Okay, so now that means that in principle, when you write down, if I give you G, epsilon, M, and M bar, and the group element G, there is still a 2x2 matrix to be organized depending on the ambiguity in plus or minus. So there are four types of functions which will appear in the unit, looking at the unitary representation. So we call them, they will play a role, k plus minus, plus minus, and you calculate for each value of plus or minus, you can do the calculation. So how would the things which are going to be vertex operators, how do they look like? So they have phases coming out from the behavior of M and M bar, and this is exponent I alpha times M and plus I M bar beta, and remember that both M and M bar can get any real value. And then there is a other exponent in which I took into account the information about the identity matrix, this is here. And then you have to look at what sits inside here. And in general, one notes this stuff here, J is IM minus, lambda is IM minus J, and lambda bar, mu is IM bar minus J. Now these are four functions, but actually it turns out that there are only two independent functions. So you choose out of this the basis of K plus plus and K minus minus, this is our choice. And we work, you will see later why, in region one, which was one of the whiskers. So there we make a choice of to choose k plus plus and k minus minus. There it's a good choice. They can form a basis. And these functions are known. And this is how they look like. So it is a bunch of beta functions, a bunch of powers, and then some hypergeometric functions multiplying them. Now, in order to look at physics, we will afterwards take some limits, and we will see how these functions relate to physics. But this is how the vertex operators look on SL2R. Now a particularly interesting one is the combination k plus plus minus some coefficient times k minus minus. What is special about it is that when you look at that near b equals zero, which is a point in your manifold, you see that you get a very simple power-like behavior, which means the system looks blue-shifted, and which means that if you integrate over it by, I don't know, Riemann-Lebesgue or whatever, you're going to get a smooth behavior for that system. You can make it vanishing on one past horizon of the system. So this is chosen so that this is its behavior at b equal to zero. That's the choice, if you wish, of the boundary condition on the problem. Omega is given by the difference between m bar and m. Now take this one, after you have determined it through the boundary conditions that this is its behavior at b equal to zero, and look about it at a large spatial direction theta. What you will get here is actually a scattering, something which looks like a scattering experiment. You're going to get the exponents, appropriate exponents, and then inside you will get, if W and S have the same sign, you will have an incoming wave, and then this will be the outgoing wave, and this is going to be the reflection coefficient. And you can ask yourself, so what is the time direction? In this case, it's beta minus alpha. Another spatial direction is alpha plus beta. Alpha and beta were again the things which multiplied the Z axis rotation, and omega and gamma are m bar minus m and m plus m bar. So if you got lost in the mass and you want to go back to the physics of the problem, here is a vertex operator which obeys a blue shifted, which you can integrate over relation on one horizon, and which looks like a scattering experiment at far away. Now you can ask yourself, in particular, is this S matrix smaller in absolute values? R smaller than one or not? In smaller or equal to one? And yes, it is smaller or equal to one for this scattering experiment, where actually what you see is scattering by the curvature. And this object R, which will play a role afterwards in the coset, is some relation between gamma functions. So you can extract it, see it, and look at it. And actually, in some of the things which we understand less, one can say that if you take two-point functions in Euclidean versions, analytically continue, and take k to infinity, they look like that. So if you wish, this gives you the feeling that indeed you have isolated an object which is of importance in the problem. Now this was for the continuous series. For the discrete series, epsilon, remember, epsilon was the thing which sat in here in the ket. So epsilon gets washed away, there is no epsilon, even when you have a universe in cover. You have just, J determines the function. J, on the other hand, is now not, I mean, it gets any, it can obtain any value. M, again, obtains any value. There is also no plus or minus ambiguity. There is only one combination of the four, which is a legal combination. So this is what happens in the discrete series. So now let's go to the coset. And you will see it was worthwhile to go to the to do all that, because actually the transition with the vertex operator from the group to the coset are more or less immediate. So all the work was done here. And in going to the coset, it's just substitutions in the functions which you already know. So what about the coset geometry? So as we said, this is what we have, and let's say the attendant manifold is, let's say, M6. And here is G and G prime. We have an element in SL2R and in SU2, and we are identifying them. So G is multiplied from the left and from the right by a certain gauge transformation. Rho and tau are parameters of the gauge transformation. And G prime is also multiplied by two parameters of the gauge transformation. Now, as we said, G has 12 patches. What about G prime? So G prime, this is a familiar Euler representation. This is how it looks. And it has compact variables, beta prime, alpha prime, and the theta prime. Now do the gauge transformation. The result of the gauge transformation is going to take alpha, which was one of the Euler angles, into alpha plus rho, beta to beta plus tau. Alpha prime will also shift. So you see that alpha minus alpha prime and beta minus beta prime are fixed. Theta prime goes to theta, and theta goes to theta, and theta prime goes to theta. Okay, so now you have to do gauge fixing. Now there are two ways to do the gauge fixing. In the paper of Nappi and Witten, you will find that the gauge fixing is done inside the SL2R. When you do the gauge fixing inside the SL2R, you set alpha and beta equals to zero. You get four coordinates, as you expect for this manifold. So you have a sphere with three coordinates, the SU2, and then you have the non-compact parameter of SL2R, and you should also have, of course, the discrete parameters epsilon1, epsilon2, and L. So what does this mean? If I think of theta as some control parameter of the problem, in some regions you can think about it as time, then you have a family of SU2 manifolds. So for every value of theta, you would get SU2 manifold. And actually this identification breaks down when theta vanishes, so theta equals pi over 2. This would again cause one of the ABCs of these to vanish. And in that case, this is not a complete fixing, and you have to do more gauge fixing. I won't discuss it from their point of view. The extra gauge fixing actually twists the spheres. So you get that these spheres which start, increase, and then actually will shrink again, you have to put on them at certain points. You will have to do twists. You will have to twist them. They're not simple spheres. We instead choose to gauge fix in SU2. In SU2, we take alpha prime and beta prime to vanish. This leaves us the following four parameters. Theta prime, which is a compact parameter in SU2. And then we have in SL2R the whole parameters, the alpha, beta, and theta, which I described in a lot of detail on how these manifolds look. So now, as a function of theta prime, you have many SL2R manifolds. However, this is not the whole story. So, because, remember, when you do the gauge fixing, we remember that the group element is well defined, but the gauge parameter has some global structure on it. Okay, no one's transparent here, but let me just remind you. So if I write down an exponent of I alpha prime sigma 3, for example, an exponent of I beta prime sigma 3, and then in the middle I exponent of I theta prime sigma 2, that beta prime and alpha prime, there are many values of beta prime and alpha prime which determine the same group element. So you haven't done the gauge fixing completely. And when you do the gauge fixing completely, you find that if if you take the gauge parameters rho plus tau to be 2 pi times an integer and rho minus pi to be 2 pi times another integer, this leaves g prime unchanged. So that means if I have now a further gauge condition, it means I have to make identifications. But the identification will have to be done on g. So the story that I told you about the space g will now look differently. So it's true that there's a parameter theta prime in SU2, but SL2R will not look like it was before. I'm going to get fundamental domains in SL2R, which will be quotiated by the boost, which you discussed before. And in particular, as we have this Z cross Z residual gate symmetry, A goes to A times exponent 2 pi and 1. D, of course, A times D is constant, so it will go the opposite. B goes like exponent 2 pi and 2. This would go the opposite. So we will have to make this identification. And this identification is going to change the geometry of our system. And from now on, we are going to have, this was your question as you asked a while ago, you see now that I have a fundamental domain, so I can't go as far away as I want, because I'm repeating myself something I already had. So this is the identifications. Now, on top of identifications, we will come later, there are fixed points for these identifications. And the fixed points of the identification, for example, happen when the surface, let's say, when the A and D surfaces intersect. Because then I have here 0, A equals 0 and D equals 0, and then I can multiply by any number, it doesn't matter, it's a fixed point. And the same would happen on the other side. So there's going to be a Z cross M2 equals 0 invariance, and there is going to be a N1 equals 0 cross Z invariance. So these are going now to become, if you wish, orbifolds in the gauge part. Because here I have a fixed point, not just an identification. These we will reach in a while, but let's start with the identification. So what the identification causes is that we get fundamental domains, and in particular the ratios B over C and A over D in the fundamental domain are bounded, for example, between 1 and exponent of, never mind, some number smaller than 1. So that's the fundamental domain. So if before we had this space in which we had all points, now we are going to get horns of this nature, both forward, backward, and left and right. And then, from the point of view of the Arab, of the Roman numerals, these things have to meet. This has to meet that. And they close in this form. And we are going to get very soon to the picture which I have discussed before. But in any case, if you amplify the region near the origin, and you need some p-duality to justify that, which I won't discuss here, then you actually get a picture which is very near the Milne structure. But in general, independent of if you want to focus around that part or not, you have these identifications that you have to make. So the group which looked before, the manifold which looked before like this, after you do the identification, is going to look like that. And that's one of the pictures that I described in the beginning. So now you see that here, David, you are really compact. That's because you're in a fundamental domain, so you can't move. While here, you can go all the way to infinity in each one of the Arab numerals. So this is how this system looks like. Now somebody asked the metric. So here, for example, here is a metric. And here, for example, the metric for the regions where W is smaller than 2, which are these regions here. So in this region, you have a clear time component, that's theta. The parameter theta would set in cosine theta minus sine theta cosine theta, that's the time. And if you look at the metric components, what you see is that one direction vanishes, let's say at this point, so the volume goes to zero. It's not isotropical. When it, then the sink increases, it's large on the equator, let's say generically when theta equals some pi over 4. And then when you go to pi over 2, you reach a point here, but at this point, a different dimension goes to zero.
So what's happening at that point? Singularity.
Well, classically, there is a, you would say there is a singularity. So the volume vanishes.
Singularity. So it's just like the Bellex. Just it's occurring. It's a four-dimensional or a two-dimensional.
It's a two-dimensional, co-dimension two thing, and it happens. Well, okay, they're different. We'll discuss. But let's say co-dimension two, and what happens is. And if you wish, the picture is the volume vanishes here and here, but the reason the volume vanishes is different here and here. Here there is one direction where whose g gets multiplied by zero, and here it's a different dimension who gets multiplied by zero. And this is what the story is told here by the metric. Then there is also a torsion, and there is also a dilaton. So for theta equals zero, it's the lambda minus component which vanishes. For theta equal pi over 2, it's the lambda plus, g lambda plus, which vanishes. And if you would like now to go, let's say, to a large K limit, then you would say that at large K, inside here, you have a bang, a large universe, and then a crunch.
Phi is the dilaton node?
Phi is the dilaton node. That there are points where the dilaton will become singular.
Where?
Well, the other points where the this
oh,
where you will see
theta pi
yeah. Well, here you won't see them, but so easily, yeah. But you can take also here. You see them easier for coming from the other direction. No, it turns out that when you do the geometry, it's at the singularity. Okay, and as I told you, we are guided here by the principle that this is semi-classical. We have a coset theory, we have a parameter, and we expand it. Okay, this is from the point of view of looking at the singularities. On this transparency, I'll show you where they come from, how they come from. Now, so you have a series of big bangs and big crunches, and then you go to the regions which are Arab numerals, which W in absolute value is larger than 2. There, this is how the metric looks like. The metric is not a function of epsilon. So you can just see it. This is the metric in the various patches. The vertex operators know about the different patches. The metric doesn't know about these various patches. And in particular, theta and theta prime have the following qualities. Theta goes to infinity. Theta prime is a compact variable. And in mind, everything is prime is SU2. So it came with a compact variable. And then in here, lambda plus and lambda minus are alpha plus beta and alpha minus beta. Originally, alpha and beta were both non-compact variables. But after having fundamental domains, alpha and beta are compact. So both these are now compact. So in particular, you can have a situation, forget now the singularity in here, which I will discuss. That's a time-like singularity, which I will discuss in a while. Just think about this guy here. This guy here is compact. And it's a time. So they are going to be at each point in space. There is a closed timeline curve. These are the closed timeline curves which the series delta's. So we try to avoid them by going to the cover, but the SU2 reproduced them. And in the end, I will try to say words why maybe how you can turn a liability into an asset. But yes, they come because of the SU2. Because it was the fact that we
SU2 has this compact.
Has this compact stuff, so I needed to make further, I didn't completely gauge fix. This caused me to make the identifications, then that closed that part.
I don't want to interrupt, but I understand now geometrically what the constructions you're doing, and I think it's. So, do you want me to say now, or should I wait till you end?
Okay.
If it illuminates,
maybe for the rest of the audience.
It helps.
I'm sorry to do this, but suddenly everything you said made a lot more sense to me. Maybe I
would ignore this.
All right, so, check.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so for me, okay, so we have the usual ADS, okay, in global coordinates, and we know that it sort of, you know, fills up this cylinder. And it usually sort of is written in some form where you have r squared plus 1, d squared plus the r squared over r squared plus 1. This is the global. Okay. But there's another way of writing ADS, which is crucial for this BTZ black hole. Okay, and the identification you're doing is sort of easier to see with the BTZ black hole. So basically, rather than using sort of global time here, you use a boost. Sometimes one of these boosts comes. And if you adopt coordinates to those boosts, the metric, just ordinary ADS, takes this form, minus 1. Well, this is 3 dimensions, so it should be 5. So this is now going to be 5, some other. So this is now a parameter along a boost. This is a different time. That's the global time. I mean, this is a parameter along a boost, like this, the Schwarzschild time of the black hole. So this looks like the BTZ black hole, and indeed, the BTZ people wrote ADS in this form and said, okay, all we have to do is identify along this boost, make chi compact, and we get a black hole. Mm-hmm. And so r equals 1 is just the horizon of the black hole. So in your construction, you've basically taken ADS3 and made two identifications. You've made this boost compact and this boost compact. So it's like making this T periodic and chi periodic. Okay. Yeah. So chi periodic is what we're sort of used to in the BTZ black hole. T periodic means that in the region here, okay, so this is the usual sort of BTZ black hole singularity, and these are the sort of asymptotic and ADS regions. Making T periodic just means that the space-like sections here are now compact and are just circles. So this is the region that you were calling the sort of cosmological model. Mm-hmm. It's topologically a torus, because you have the space-like T and the space-like chi. In this region, the chi circles go to 0, because this is r equals 0. And in this region, the T circles go to 0, because that's the horizon, r equals 1. Mm-hmm. And now in this region, this is your other wedge, you have closed time-like curves, because T is time-like and you've made it compact. So the regions that go out to infinity and R all have closed time-like curves. And they meet here.
Yep.
Okay. But now he has the cover of this.
Somehow, right? If he had the cover, you also here are probably not careful with the cover.
Well, you think you want to repeat this.
This repeats, yeah.
Okay, so yes, because this in some sense is all just this part of the original ADS.
Right.
And so yes, you can continue this above this beyond the point where these circles shrink, and it essentially repeats in some sense. And you can see the four regions, 1, 2, 3, 4, that are sort of touching here, as you were saying.
So you need to see 12 somehow. So you need another three probably.
The repetition gets some phases.
But it's a little bit, let's say, for a basic, sub-basic,
yeah, so you call it together a BTZ black hole.
Yeah, for the picture. Okay, so thank you. And now, if I go on, let me look a little bit at the singularity. So first, I will mention something which we'll discuss in a moment. Note that here there is a singularity. In this here and here there is a singularity. And who is time-like and who is space-like is going to switch in here, like in a black hole. In a sense, like in a black hole. But in any case, this is going to happen, and we'll discuss what is the origin of this. From the point of view of the vertex operators, it's not a real singularity. But if you want, we will reach, if you want to describe the physics looks very different on both sides of that singularity.
Because on that, the way Gary was describing it, there doesn't seem to be any singularity.
Well, there is a singularity when you make identifications, because you've, you know, that you know, point on the horizon where the two horizons meet is no longer smooth.
No, singularity there.
That's different.
That's different.
Let me reach it and then we discuss it, because this we will see is particular for the cosine, this singularity. It comes when the determinant of g plus v vanishes. Let's wait a moment to appreciate the singularity. First, let's discuss the other singularities. So in particular, when we look at the system and we think that we made the identification, remember we had to do an orbifold, and the orbifold in the gate group has fixed points. But remember, what we believe the advantage here in the gate theory, unlike if you start and state, I have a theory and I make orbifolds, and I put in singularities, then I have to take the rules of whatever appropriate chapter in some book is, and know how to do stuff when you have orbifolds, and see if you have to modify it or not. But from the point of view of the gate theory, all this stuff is already taken into account. You don't have to do this book accounting separately. And that's one of our beliefs why this description actually would give a sensible answer. In any case, when we take theta and theta prime coordinate 0, or in less fancy language, when we have the unit element in both g and in g prime, then they're actually the fixed point from being a z orbifold becomes a continuous u1 orbifold. Because now any gauge transformation with rho, with a gauge parameter rho for one u1 and tau for the other parameter, when they are equal up to a sign, then this gives a fixed point. And that's where the singularity is. And the other singularity is when theta equals theta prime. In that case, g and g prime are I sigma 2. And for the I sigma 2, you have a much larger, the fixed point is much larger, and the discrete orbifold becomes a continuous orbifold. Now there is a singularity, time-like singularity. What is its origin? So maybe, again, it would be nice to hear how Jerry looks at it, but from a point of view of not a relativist, but a string theorist, what we looked is, we looked at the original data of the nonlinear sigma model, and we like to organize it in G and B. G is the metric and B is the torsion. And you write the matrix E, which has nice modular properties, which is the sum of them. Now this is on the group. We had a Wessel-Meno product of affine algebra models. Now, when one gauges it, you get an induced G and induced B. So look at the induced E. And the induced E has a determinant which vanishes at the point of that singularity. So this is really a property of the way you do the cosine. I don't know exactly how you would see it in your language, but there must be some analogous description for that extra piece. But let's say for a string theorist, we would say that's a point where the determinant of G plus V vanishes. Okay, now tell me how much more I have, and I will wind 5 minutes, 2 minutes, zero, minus one.
We just have coffee. Yeah.
Well,
this tier, it's pretty 15. So this is the setup, if you wish. This is the system. And now one needs the results on the system. And now the very nice thing about it is that you can write down the vertex operator. How do you write them down? You take the vertex operators of SL2 cross SU2. And all you do is you put correlations between M and M prime. That's all. Now, if you think from the point of view of data, that's again something I would like to know more from a general relativist, how you would look at it. Because it's very clear to me that if you give me all the vertex operators on SL2R and SU2 by some Poissonian summation, I can tell you what the geometric data was and what was my manifold. But now I have this enormous matrix, and I'm saying that most of the matrix elements are projected out. I'm not interested in them. So I just pick a very small subset of that. So now this must, again, encoding it in some inverse scattering problem, the geometry of the cosine. And I don't know what the mathematical tool is, how to get back from the cosine part to now get back the geometry, which we do usually by gauging, integrating out the gauge field, having a change G, a change B, a change phi. But just presenting it, here I give you the vertex operators. This is some solution in general relativity of some particle propagating, and I just took SL2R over SU2, and I threw away a lot of stuff, and I just keep some stuff. And that stuff which remained is encoding another type of geometry. However, as you guess, the problem is, or the feature or bug that is to be seen, is that things are smooth in SL2R plus SU2. So things are going to remain smooth in this model. Vertex operators are going to live happily in many, many places. and you know what the value is, and you're not going to get big catastrophes. So I skipped that, and I just tell you that, for example, I go here and one more feature. So let's say if you look at this object here, which I described before in SM2R, which was a scattering against the curvature of the coordinates which you have chosen. So in a particular set of coordinates, there is a preferred center, and because you chose coordinates, and now there was a scattering. And now this scattering, you can again look at the reflection coefficient, and the reflection coefficient turns out to be smaller or equal to 1. So now you can scatter over the Big Bang. But what you don't get is, for example, now again, general relativity versus string theory maybe, is that what would be a dream? A dream would be, you do a scattering in here against the Big Bang, and you get that the vertex operator everywhere else vanishes. So if the vertex operator vanishes everywhere else, so I could...
How do you scatter? What do you mean scatter?
I go here...
There's no infinite time.
But there is infinite space. So I go to a place which is far away, and in that place I see a plane wave. And this plane wave, I see an incoming plane wave, and I see an outgoing plane wave.
Plane wave and time.
And remember, it should be surprised. All what happened? What does the gauging ensure? It ensures that all this is consistent.
It's going around these timeline curves.
Yes. That you don't have to choose such a trajectory. You can go around another trajectory.
But the space has closed timeline curves
in
that region.
Yes. Yeah.
The wave has to propagate consistently around the curve.
The wave is going around like
spiraling
in time.
Yeah.
So you'd have to move faster than the speed of light to do it without moving.
Well, I have a vertex operator which covers all. That's again the problem of string theory.
You aren't necessarily
going around. Right. But you've got to be going around the way time.
Sure.
Okay.
So frequencies are discrete or something.
Well, frequencies are, that we will reach them. So frequencies are discrete, and that's part of the thing to make it consistent.
Of course. That's what you're
saying. That's,
yeah.
That's what you're saying.
It's pretty weird.
That's the
same weirdness as the known universe. I mean, you said many copies of the known universe is weirdness.
Well, no, this is not the known universe. This is sort of the space-like part of the known universe or something. This is where you have the closed timeline curves.
It doesn't know that closed timeline.
Well, the thing that people usually talk about is just the cosmological part.
Oh, I see.
Inside the
light.
This is outside the light.
So I would say there is a vertex operator, it covers everything, it looks here like a scattering, the reflection is smaller than 1, what can I do? It could have been a number larger than 1, no, its absolute value, the reflection coefficient is smaller than 1, and the moment I put it in here, it exists everywhere. Mm-hmm. And again, I would think a nice resolution of problems would be it vanishes somewhere, everywhere else. And then, yes, we can do physics in one patch.
How is this physics? I have this thing which is going yesterday to tomorrow, yesterday to tomorrow.
Okay, so I see where David wants to live. David wants to live in this region, right? That's where he wants to live. But the thing is, the fact is, and afterwards we can discuss if you wish, holographic issues, why you have to have these places here. But it's true, one attitude is to say, I want to live and do scattering experiments here. I hope that I live in a situation where K is very large, so my equator is very large, and I build CERN or SLAC somewhere here, and there I do my scattering experiments. Okay? That's something.
The question is, what if you build CERN in one of the sideways places?
Okay, so CERN in the sideways places, that's... you have two types of functions. You have discrete series, and you have the. Okay, I have to do it fast. But as you said, things will get discretized, and they get discretized because of the SU2. So there is a large depletion, you can see already in the number of states, and you end up only with those states, which would give you a theory which is consistent from my point of view. Because a generic state would give you garbage. Some small pieces do survive. So yes, you deplete an enormous number of states. And from my point of view, but now we are progressing with the preliminary results more and more, would be the following. That, okay, you have here, this is the world where you would like maybe to live in, and try to identify the discrete states actually sit concentrated around these universes. It's only the continuous guys which run away and live at the edges. The discrete representations are are damped and they can fly, enter a little bit quantum mechanically inside, but they're basically concentrated in here. Now, if you want some, I don't think holography is a principle. I think it should be derived. But let's say we believe that even though we don't know to derive it, it's there in the system. So if it isn't the system and you sit in here, you have no place for a screen. So in your world where you want to live, you can't really, you don't really have screens. So the screens are sitting here outside, and they are of this.
All right, grab the other screen.
Okay. Let me say they're not sitting at infinity in this world, right? In this world, they can't go to infinity for my screens. This is not maybe a small, in local regions, it could look a little bit like the sitter and so on. It's a different type of structure.
Do you allow worlds in the first time like that?
I don't know of any examples where you have closed time like Kurt, but where these prescriptions run into problems. But I don't think you should take that as support for
closed time.
Okay, so if we want to turn the bug into a feature, then the statement would be like this. Okay, in here, you want somehow to be able in some way to have less states than you would have, let's say, on ADS3, process 3 times some stuff, which is a two-dimensional conformal field theory with a very large central charge. And you want to have less, let's say, you want to have less states than that. So as the screens have to, you have somewhere a place where you have to set your screens. And when you do that, you need this world, if you want this large depletion representing the states here, you need this world to be of a very projective nature. And the very projective nature is, for example, by having these closed time-like curves. So don't live in here. But if you want, if you are curious and want to watch your screens, then this is how you would do your scattering.
So the screens are at infinity.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that would be the picture. And then actually from the discrete series, there would be some guys which are non-normalizable, and their exponentials in the usual picture, these exponential part could reach the screen and attach to it. While the other guys would be the wave functions, not the observables, they would sit as the wave functions, and they would be concentrated sitting in here. Okay, so I want to thank you for your patience in listening to this to that.
I'd see that.
Okay. As we are living in a time-dependent background, since the statement is not Gilgen variant. So I will just say that from our point of view at this stage, there are two things we see. We see a large depletion in the number of states, and we see the possibility to write. Again, the answer. The question is less clear, but
so,
the answer.
Okay, this is the answer to what? The string theory in this background.
In this background, but this background has, it's not, I don't think, let's say, once you say, throw this away, what a very good attitude in any case, but you say, throw away, I have a feature of closed timeline curves, let me study universes with identification. Now, I think here it's not by accident that part of the universes doesn't have closed timeline curves. And it has a cosmological nature. The other piece has it. So I don't think that this is a model for just looking at problem where everything is closed the timeline curves. Okay. Now, that's an intuition. I mean, okay.
But
Joe wanted his intuition, this is my intuition. So maybe if there is something to be learned, that maybe they have a closed timeline curve.
Are there defined physical questions one can pose?
But the only thing is the scattering, which you don't want to be involved. The scattering experiment you don't want to get involved in.
Right.
That's how. If you're looking in the corresponding thing in ADS-CFT of doing scattering, would be that going to large theta, look at something which looks like a plane wave. It looks like something once came in, something now goes out. That's what you have. Look at the
vertex operators for the discrete series.
Not for all of the series and so on.
Sorry?
All, also the continuous. Yeah.
The discrete series don't live in these.
No. There, I would say, they're only good for observe. Take, like in the ADS-CFT, take the guy which explodes, actually. The guy which explodes will somehow reach the screen.
I'm not trying to ask the question as to what the holographic dual of this is. But rather, you know, what are the observables in the string theory? Forget about the holographic.
If I can comment on the screens. So I understand your point of view is that there are going to be screens only in the green parts at infinity. And they should somehow...
Only in the Arab numerals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they should somehow be responsible for physics that's also going on in the compact. From the point of view that Suskin and Fischler and I considered, that would not be what you would expect, because what you would find by constructing screens in these individual parts is that for the green parts, indeed, you would get screens at infinity, and let you look at light cones and see where they have their maximal area, and it would be out at infinity. But there would be separate screens that would take care of the compact part, where you would get screens embedded in the middle of the space-time. You would look at the past light cone, and it would grow and then shrink again as you get to the Big Bang portion. And somewhere in the middle, there would be a screen onto which you could project your data. So from that point of view, you would not be allowed to expect that you can describe what's beyond these singular points using holographic data
this, you asked me the question about what are really the observables. Of course, that was the original thing. But what we can do in string theory is calculate BRST invariant states. I don't know to do something else. So I calculate
the calculate scattered amplitudes.
That's the next stage. But let's first, as I told you, even for example, this object, the reflection coefficient, is actually, if you do Euclidean physics, calculate the two-point function, analytically continue, and take the large K limit, it would give you that. Okay, so there is, if you wish, some information already buried in here about a two-point function. But we didn't do yet two or three-point or four-point functions in those regions separately. Now, from what Raphael says, okay, these are all, again, I give you the results. Now, the question of the interpretation of the results is really something that we're trying to somehow straighten in our minds. But what I suggested here is one type of realization of so. Yes, John?
So I think the picture is a little bit different from what you drew, because in fact, geometrically, you can go smoothly from your sort of cosmological region into one of your, I guess from one of your blue into one of your green regions.
We're talking about Romans and Arabs, so which do you...
Romans and Arabs. So I think the way the geometry works is you have this region of closed time-like curves, and you approach a boundary where you get a closed null curve, and another side of that boundary.
Well, so let's wait. Where is it? Where was the light?
The
trick of getting the light.
Yeah, there's a little light switch right here.
Okay, so let's say if we amplify a region here.
Yeah.
So in here we have this and this and this and that. Now please maybe just show up.
It's very similar. Let's start with, you have a region like this. So if you just take this and think of it as sort of a light cone in two-dimensional Minkowski space, and we have a Wu symmetry which does this.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So we have a Wu symmetry. And now you just sort of take a quotient with the discrete groups.
Yeah.
Okay. What happens is that, of course, you get closed timeline curves here, and you get a compact universe here. But there are still null GD6s, right, which start in this region and go into this region and go smoothly right across. So under the boost, this null line gets identified. So you have a closed null curve here, just space like curves here. It becomes null, then it becomes time-like. But there's a smooth boundary here. This is something which is sometimes called a Misner boundary in relativity. It's present in things like the Talmud universe. But there's a smooth space-time which actually interpolates, matches up this cosmological-like region into a thing. And the way you can picture it is if you look at, start here, okay, so you have a cylinder, you have some sort of closed universe and your light cones are all fine. And then you have a region here, and the light cones start tipping over, mm-hmm. and they become null. And then, to the future, they sort of tip all the way over, and you get closed time-like curves. Mm-hmm. So this sort of closed null curve is the one here, and this is an ordinary sort of universe.
But you don't pass any singularity.
There's no singularity here. That's what I'm saying. So there's actually a smooth boundary.
However,
the singularity is sitting right there. Okay, so there is a singularity in the sense that when you try to match sort of all four regions together, there's a singularity at the origin. But if you sort of avoid the origin, you can go smoothly from one region to the other through one of the S.
That's very different than what you're doing.
No, no, it's the same conclusion. I said that if you want to go from the different regions, when you take, if for example, you have a region here, which is plus, minus, plus, plus, okay? This would be, I think, one of the regions which are here. Now, if I want to go to a region which is plus, 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 then I will have to go, if that is what I insist, then I have to go through the situation of having B equals 0.
Right.
Okay. Now, B equals 0 is not B equals 0 and C equals 0 together.
Right.
Okay. Now, this point here is where either A and D vanish, or C and D. Well, if such a thing here, only one of them vanish.
So it's actually a new different transition across that.
That's a different. That's a different.
Does this mean the past light ones and points from the compact region actually get to the non-compact region without going to the singularity?
It means that the... Yeah, I mean, it's actually, in this picture...
Our picture was the tachyons, let's say, we call these places hells, let's say. Definitely the way you describe the scattering there is not happy. So if you scatter a tachyon, for example, from here, it will remain in hell. It won't come back. Because its scattering will all the time push it outside. On the other hand, if you take a massless particle, it will succeed in crossing. And if you have a massive particle, it actually would only need to spend a few cycles, maybe in hell, and then come back.
But you can't go smoothly from the bottom.
You can't go from the bottom to the top, that's true. Without going through one of these other regions. You could, if you're a time-like particle, you can go from the bottom to the top smoothly through one of these regions, those time-like curves.
You have to go through
another part. Isn't it saying more generally that arbitrarily small quantum correctly, the quantum regions are going to destroy this whole structure?
That's right.
No matter how small a string coupling is, on the locus where the time-like curves first appear, the quantum corrections will be arbitrarily large. And this is, even though you're doing honest control of field theory, it's not really a limited string theory.
Okay, so I know that the two things that say, there are two party lines I understand. One party line I understand is that if I have a space-like singularity, there will always be a point, it's claimed, where the energy will be very large and I will stop doing string theory. I think this is based yet on some examples. I don't think it's something which covers all possibilities, covers some orbifold situations. And the second question is, okay, I write here a vertex operator. If I would really honestly do the scattering experiment and just build that accelerator and put that little particle in, then a lot of the structure would collapse. Okay, here I'm not doing that. I'm sitting on a sphere from the point of view of the string theory. That's what I'm doing. So from the point of view of the string, on the sphere, I have that. If you ask me, you want the back reaction. You want me to calculate the back reaction and see if as a result of the back reaction all this collapses at this stage. I don't know how to do that.
I've seen people who I think want to use this room over the next couple of minutes. So why don't we do these?